Hey, Soraya.
Hey, Jeff.
So we're once again on location, right?
Our second location.
Yeah, so last week we were in the studio of Jim Hill, Rain Parade producer.
Yeah, in Sun Valley. And where are we today?
So today we're at the home of Luis Gutierrez.
Okay, if people aren't freaking out, they should be, okay, because we're sitting in his kitchen.
So this is our 35th podcast.
Yes.
And we've been having requests for podcasts with Luis for 6 months now.
At least. And let's,
from the beginning.
And at least let's tell the story.
Hi, this is Soraya.
And this is Jeff.
Our podcast is called Paisley Stage Raspberry and Rhyme.
A podcast where the two of us play music that we like and share anecdotes and background about the tunes.
We hope you'll join our conversation. And without further ado, a grubiar.
Let's get groovy.
Groovy. Groovy. Groovy. Groovy.
So Greg Alderett, friend of both of ours,
great.
And someone you know,
sure.
He's told us, you guys have to have Luis on. You have to have Luis on. And Jeff and I would look at each other and say, well, we've reached out on Facebook. We don't really have another way. And then it was just coincidence and happenstance that I saw you at the Grammy event where you were playing a Beatles song and an Easy Beat song.
Nice.
And I took advantage. I said, I'm going to shoot my shot. Let's see what happens.
You cornered me.
And you...
It wasn't really a cornering. It was more
I thought I did it nicely.
Cutting me off at the pass.
But you were very, very generous to say yes. And I will say this. This is my one bragging point. He said, who could look into those brown eyes and say no?
Oh,
and so thank you from the bottom of my heart. But really, Greg started us kind of on this quest. And you are... one of our unicorns.
Mm-hmm. One
and
of a small amount.
Literally, it's like on one hand, we can count the people that we really, really want to talk to and haven't been able to, and you are one of them. So thank you so, so much for inviting us in. So
good to be here.
Doesn't that make you feel happy?
Yes.
Oh, I feel so happy. All right, Jeff, so get us started.
All right. So today on the podcast, we have an incredible guest, as we mentioned earlier. Luis Gutierrez, a man of many talents, notable in many areas from music and finance to many things in between. Fans of our podcast will recognize Luis from his time with Salvation Army, The 3 O'Clock, Mary's Danish, Battery Acid, as well as numerous other credits, including playing with artists like Sky Saxon and Neil Diamond. We've been fortunate to see Luis on guitar again over the past few years thanks to some of the reunion dates. With the 3 O'Clock beginning in 2013, and most recently at the May 2019 show at for the 3x4 at the Grammy that Soraya went to. That was in Los Angeles, and the Beatles show that Soraya just mentioned. Luis's passion for the things that drive him, music, his family, business, adventure, and two beautiful dogs, I might add.
Yeah.
this is evident, and his story was fascinating to us, so... we'd like to welcome you, Luis, to Paisley Stage Raspberry and Rhyme.
Good to be here.
Yay!
Yay!
All right, so I want to start off with, and please correct the name. So online, he's known as Kenny Da Silva, but mm-hmm. Is it Kenny Ogihara?
Kenny Ogihara is his Japanese name. Da Silva was his American name.
Okay.
His aunt lived in San Pedro and was married to... I guess a World War II guy, and they kind of ended up in San Pedro, and Kenny took on their name when he came here as an exchange student.
Got it. Okay. So Kenny Da Silva online, and this is, I went back in the archives. 2010, he posts on Facebook on the 3 O'Clock page, I'm looking for Luis Gutierrez. And so he, and for those of you who've seen The Decline of Western Civilization Part 1, Kenny's in there. And has some pretty memorable, has a pretty memorable scene. But in a 2010 Facebook post where he was trying to locate you, he said, quote, I made you a punk. Is this true? And how do you get connected to the LA punk scene?
Yes, it's true. Kenny, I had just changed high schools for the second time. I had gone from Narbonne High School to San Pedro High School. And Kenny and I sat at the back of the class for our fourth period English class. And I had long surfer hair and wore OP shorts and Vans tennis shoes. And Kenny would wear a swastika, bright red swastika shirt. with Sid Vicious lock around his neck and just boots and just chains and all sorts of things, leather pants. And he called me a hippie and I called him a freak. And he goes, "No, you're a hippie." And I said, "No, you're a freak." And we just kind of got along. And then he goes, "You got to come to Hollywood with me to check out a band. You know, you'd really like it." And so at some point I went out after the end of the school year, I went to Hollywood with him one night, and I can't remember the band, but it was probably the Circle Jerks or Wall of Voodoo or somebody like that at the Starwood, I think it was.
Oh, wow.
And it was just such an exciting scene, and I felt really out of place because I had this super long hair, and I just kind of started going out to shows with him, and eventually I cut my hair and I bleached it white and put a black stripe down the center, and I was nicknamed Skunk Brain. and that was sort of the beginning of it, that summer of 1980.
So would you mind walking us back? What prompted the change in high school? Because this is a really interesting part of your history.
Yeah, so I had gone to Bishop Montgomery High School, but I just wasn't engaged academically, and so I was asked to transfer to another school. So that led me to Narbonne High School. And Narbonne High School, at that time, 1978, 79, 80, they were really in full swing with integration in the LA Unified School District. And so that brought a new dynamic to Narbonne High School because it was a public school, it was a large school, it was kind of a tough school, and big football team, big sports program. And this one guy who called himself Candyman or Mr. Candyman would come to school every day wearing Dickie's work clothing, like either brown or all black or all blue. And he had in old English letters across his back and down his arms and down his legs, Mr. Candyman. And at some point, and that was fine, but at some point he was trying to extort money from a friend of mine, Peter Diavola, and who was in the 11th grade. And so this is now first semester of 12th grade. And so one day I confronted him and I said, "Look, it's got to stop, man. You know, we got to get along. We don't necessarily want you guys here. You don't really want to be here. It's causing a lot of tension, but you can't be taking money from my friend. That's going to end right here and now." He kind of was kind of surprised that this kind of scrawny 5'10 kid would go up to him, who was probably 6'2", 6'3".
Wow.
And so I just kind of walked away. And then later that day, I think it was during nutritional break, I was in line in the cafeteria with two or three girls, these friends of mine, and he came up to me with one of his friends, or maybe two friends, and started calling me a honky and a whitey, and you know, said, "I'm gonna shank you, and I'm gonna stab you, and I'm gonna this, I'm gonna that." I'm like, "Okay, give me your best shot. I go, you're coming to me when I'm getting my honey bun at nutrition with two girls, when you're with your friends." I said, "Come on, man." So basically, we decided we were gonna have a fight. And so that was going to happen the next day at noon, or maybe later that day. And I did what I usually did at that time in my life, was that I would at lunch I would go and smoke pot with my friend out on the football field. Mm-hmm. And so I came back and I was a little buzzed, and suddenly there was all sorts of lots and lots and lots of African Americans gathered in the quad between the auditorium and the cafeteria. And I'm like, "Oh yeah, I'm supposed to fight this guy." Like, I had kind of forgotten. I hadn't really focused on it. And so now I'm walking through these people and they're kind of pushing me, and I'm, you know, next thing I know, I'm confronted face to face with Candyman, and I'm looking up at him and he's looking down at me and he's screaming at me, and everybody's screaming around me. And I realized in that moment that I was probably going to lose the fight, but I only had one shot. So I did what I had to do and I hit him as hard as I could. And he goes down, and I jumped on top of him. Next thing I know, people were hitting me and pulling on my hair, and it got really bad. And suddenly, friends of mine started fighting with people on the perimeter because I was, you know, everybody kind of knew each other at that school, so people were coming to my defense. And somebody hit me over the head with the back of an aluminum trash can lid, and it would have gotten much worse, but suddenly I felt this big, gigantic hand pull me by the back of my hoodie, which I was wearing, out from the middle of this fight, and it was Mr. Backstrom, who was our disciplinary dean, He was like an off-duty cop or a retired cop or something like that. And he pulled me into the library, and we got chased, and they were banging on the door, and then the lunch bell rang, fifth period began, and that was it. So they gave me what they called an opportunity transfer. And I explained that I was simply sticking up for my friend Peter, and that I was telling the guy, look, don't threaten to beat him up and take his money, because he'd been doing it for a while. And so they gave me an opportunity transfer to go to either Banning or Carson or San Pedro High, and I chose San Pedro.
Isn't that wild? Opportunity transfer, yeah. And then, you know, and then this meeting with Kenny, and then, okay, wow, that's pretty cool.
Sounds like a quick way to blow a buzz right there.
Well, needless to say.
Pot back then wasn't very strong, so it's not like it is today.
Well, we wanted to get into Salvation Army. So you get into punk music from introduction from Kenny, and we've heard many people note Salvation Army as an influence, namely Green Day.
Yeah.
And then Danny Bonner has mentioned that on our show.
He said he was blown away the first time he heard.
So we wanted to know how you first met Michael Quercio and come to join Salvation Army, and what was the sound or identity of the band when you first got started?
Sure. So there were two bands before there was Salvation Army for me. The first one was Ozzy Hares, and that was in the fall of 1980. And I bring that up because, interestingly, Tony Alva, who's the famous skateboarder, who I really looked up to because I skated and surfed when I was young, and I saw him win like the world championships in Long Beach 3 or 4 years before, I found myself in a band with him.
Wow.
And also notably, the drummer in that band was Emil Terzantz, I think his last name was. He ended up in Black Flag. Our very first gig, 3 or 4 weeks later, was opening for Black Flag, the Circle Jerks, and the Descendants.
Wow.
And possibly the Minutemen. I'm not certain, but I think they were on the bill too. And it was in San Pedro, not far from Dancing Waters, at this tiny little club. And I didn't think anything of it at the time, but it was, wow.
Yeah.
Really cool. And what I loved about punk is that you didn't have to be a great guitar player. You didn't have to be the guy from Led Zeppelin or the guy from Yes or the guy from Supertramp. Because those are all that was the music that I grew up listening to through my older siblings.
Mm-hmm.
That's what they listened to. So I always thought, well, I played guitar. I started when I was 14, I guess.
Wow.
But I liked it because if you know how to play a bar chord, you could play any song. And so that really appealed to me. And so Ozzy Hares led to another band called Youth Brigade,
yes,
which was a very popular punk band at the time, and they still may be together, I think. They were part of an organization called the Better Youth Organization, and anyway, bottom line is that they were in Hollywood at the time. I was still living in between Hollywood and home, because I had moved out when I was 18 or 19, and but at that time, I was living at my mom's house, and somebody introduced me to Michael Quercio.
Huh?
And I can't remember who it was. It may have been this guy named Brian Swilly. It may have been Troy Howell was a connection. I don't really remember, but I remember meeting Mike at his house, and I played with them in Mike's garage, and I think either on the spot or the next day, he called me and said, would you like to join the band? Because I think at that point, John Blazing was already out, and they mm-hmm. were looking for somebody new. And they had already put out the single. And I don't know, it all happened so quickly from there. We were playing all the time. By now, it's like 1981, I want to say. Late 81. You can ask Mike. Mike has a really good memory for that kind of stuff. And, it just led to a bunch of gigs. We'll be right back.
change.
Alpine Village, we used to play there all the time. We played at parties. I think we played at Lena's garage, in her garage once, in Carson, I think it was. And, you know, when you're 19 years old or 18 years old, you just don't really think about it. It's just kind of normal. We were just writing songs like, wow, this is kind of cool. And you're discovering the songwriting process and the song structure. As you're not taught how to write songs and how to form melodies and stuff like that, you just kind of evolve your own understanding of it, and that's kind of how I got there. And then I don't know, somehow we did an EP, I think, like a 5-song demo, which led us to Lisa Fancher, which led to that first record, which we did in 3 days, I think. Which led to the producer wanting to kick not just Troy out of the band, but me out of the band.
Oh.
Because he thought we both sucked. And he wanted to keep Michael, because Michael clearly had something special. He could sing, he could play bass, he could play bass really well, he could write songs, and he had a very unique perspective on music.
That's interesting.
Would you like me to put the dogs in the,
no.
In the bed? So Michael stood up for me and said, well, maybe we'll get a new drummer, but I'm going to keep this guy Greg.
Wow. Because we heard the story from Troy.
Exactly.
And that he felt really bad that he was pretty much asked to leave the band from the producer that was recording. So this is new news to us.
This is completely new to us. The producer. Yeah.
I guess he had his own idea for the band, right?
We were pretty raw. I mean, we just were young and inexperienced. It's really amazing. He had studied music so much by that point that he really had clear directions on what he wanted to do in the studio. And I think the producer felt overwhelmed by Michael because Michael wouldn't just listen to him. He said, no, we're going to do it this way.
Wow.
Which led to him doing all of his vocals in the bathroom. Because it had sort of an ambient room, and he wanted to do it there. And Tom Wilson hated it. But what could he say? So I think it was a really interesting experience for the three of us, Troy, Mike, and myself. But for the producer, it just was a bad experience, and he hated it, which is why he didn't want his name on it. Which is why his name isn't on the record.
H.P. Lovecraft.
Right, that's right.
Produced.
What a buggeries. God. Oof. All right. So first of all, I'm just kind of letting that sink in. Because I find it really interesting that the producer said, Troy and Lewis suck. And then when people listen to your guitar, it's like, it's mind blowing. And so I'm trying to figure out what he was trying to listen for or hear. But okay. So that, I want to bring Salvation Army back into the present day, because Record Store Day release this year in April is a live recording. Did it surprise you that they want to do a Record Store Day release and that this comes out?
That live recording is from Wilson Park,
right?
It surprised me that somebody had recorded that. I didn't know it existed. So it was a sort of a double surprise for me, in the sense that, oh yeah, there's this recording from 1982, and oh yeah, they're going to release it on this thing called Record Store Day. Because I'm pretty much out of the music business entirely. And I have not really stayed up with the band and all the various iterations of the band. I mean, and candidly, I never listened to any of the records in their entirety after I left the band. Not I think there were two, or were there three?
Salvation Army?
No, 3 o'clock after I left the band.
Two after you left.
Two.
Yeah. I'd never listened to them. I mean, I've heard bits of them, but I just...
That's enough.
Because I just moved on, you know? I was moving on to something else.
Yeah.
So Record Store Day, I mean, it's flattering to have somebody take an interest in something you did so long ago. I mean, when was it? 35 years ago? 37 years ago?
At least.
That's almost 2.5 lifetimes from the age that I was when we did it, right? I'm now 56. No, so you can imagine that at that time, and this news came, I think, while we were in the studio. It may have been like either the last day of recording or soon thereafter. And in the middle of that, we met Danny Bonair, obviously. I liked the record. I thought it was a good record. I wish that I wasn't totally in love with the guitar sound, but I liked the guitar sound. Mm-hmm. It's kind of tinny sounding, and it has a lot of reverb on it, and I wish it had been more present. But I think that the way that the producer mixed it was to try and create this sort of ambient sound to try and mask some of the inefficiencies of the band at the time.
Interesting.
I find that fascinating.
Yeah, absolutely.
I find it fascinating. We move into Paisley Underground. So one of the things that we've asked Steve Wynn, we've asked Michael Curcio, we've asked Danny Bonair, Matt Fiucci, and then Zelinkas, we've asked so many people the same question. What was this Paisley Underground scene like?
For me, it began the night that we were performing at the Music Machine Venice Boulevard, I think it was, in West LA, and we had opened for a band called, they were all black, and they had like hair in front of their face, and I can't remember the name of the band. Michael would remember.
Maybe The Unclaimed?
Yeah, The Unclaimed.
Yeah.
And it was Shelly Ganson in that band?
Yes.
And I remember the Bengals were all there to see us. At least Susanna was there, Susanna Hoffs, and I remember just, it was a small stage and moving around, and I inadvertently, accidentally hit her in the head with my guitar, and that sort of, I immediately threw my guitar down and said, oh, I'm so sorry, and we just struck up a friendship, and it was, I think, in that moment for me that I realized that there were a lot of bands that were sort of pursuing similar music.
Mm-hmm.
It may have happened before then, but that was a crystallizing moment in my mind, because we met all these people backstage, and they all seemed to be really into the same kind of music.
So at this point, Salvation Army is kind of transitioning their sound. I mean, because we know that from what Troy told us, some of the songs that are on Baroque Hoedown, he played on, and then he was out Danny Bonnier's in, and then there's a name change.
You'd have to go to the historian and BAM for that. I don't know. I think that night at Club 88 was Salvation Army with Troy Al.
Got it. Okay.
So with the Paisley Underground, with multiple conversations that we've had, there's two events that keep coming up, one being the Catalina trip and one being barbecue events that were hosted by the Green on Red. Were you present for...
Sure. So the Catalina event happened because it was my idea, and the reason it happened is that growing up, when I was 15 and 16, I had some friends who were older, and they would go to Catalina to work for the summer.
Oh, nice.
And so I would go and visit them, and we'd just go out and party, and we'd end up on, like, a golf course where there was a big green, and we'd sleep on that and just party and just have a great time.
Camp outs.
Yeah, like a camp out. You know, you could do that kind of stuff back then. I doubt you could do it now. And I had the idea, well, why don't we all go to Catalina and camp on the golf course? I've done it. It's really fun. So we ended up doing it. And I know the Bengals were there, and I think Dream Syndicate was there. Troy Howell and Michael and I were there. And anyway, I can't remember exactly who was there, but that we just had a great time, and we went to Catalina.
Nice.
And I think in a lot of ways it sort of cemented the scene and the friendships and the bonds for all of us. And but those barbecues, I was never a part of. I didn't go to a single barbecue.
Okay.
I think that may have started happening. I don't remember why, but I didn't go to any of those barbecues.
Okay.
They talk about it. I've heard it talked about, but I have no recollection of ever being there.
Yeah,
one.
So we haven't talked to anybody that has much memory from that,
no.
Right? So
the only one who seems to talk about it with a little bit more authority is Matt Pucci, but
yeah,
not too many people have a whole lot of memories.
I think at the time, one of the Petersons were living with somebody from Green on Red.
Yeah, and Sid. And Sid Griffin.
Sid Griffin, yeah.
Yes.
Sure. I'm sure that's what it was, but I don't think I ever went to a single one.
So the Catalina trip, Lewis's idea. 3x4, the Paisley reunion, Lewis's idea.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Hold on. Paisley reunion.
Yeah, so the show at the Fonda event, which was the Music Cares charity event, which we'll cover in a little bit.
Yeah,
sure.
But that was also...
No, that wasn't my idea. That's not true. What
you
happened
keep getting
was,
credited for it.
Yes.
No, what happened was we had already done Coachella at that point, and that was John Silva's idea. He was our manager back in the day. And I don't know if you guys know the name John Silva, but we were his first band, and he was our first manager. We met him when he was a DJ or a program director up at University of San Francisco, and he was about to graduate. We said, "Hey, would you consider managing us?" And he did, and he was the band's manager all the way through. And Bonnaire had been asking me to do these reunion gigs from 1988 or 89 all the way up until 2013. I was like, "No, not into it, not interested." I mean, no offense, but I just don't have the energy or the focus. But then when I got a call from Danny about Coachella, I was like, how can I turn this down? Because I have kids that would die to go to Coachella and to be able to stand on stage, any stage they wanted to, and have an all-access artist pass. I'm like, okay, this is worthwhile. I'll do this. This is once in a lifetime. I can't pass this up. And that led to these other things that happened. But I got a call from John Silva one day saying, would you be willing to do a Paisley Underground reunion show? And I'm like, I'm not sure. You know, it takes a lot of effort to learn these songs and to practice and do all that. He goes, well, what if we did it for the charity as a fundraiser for the nonprofit that you're involved with? I'm on the board of directors of a nonprofit. It's called Education Through Music Los Angeles, and we bring quality music instruction into the most at-risk schools, Title I schools, all throughout L.A. And just a little quick sidebar on that. When I joined the board about 9 years ago, we had our annual budget was around, I don't know, $300,000, and we worked with four or five schools. This year, we're at $2.5 million is our budget, and we're working with 40 schools.
Wow.
And we have, I don't know, 40, 50, 60 employees who are our teachers, our teaching professionals. Really cool. But that night was a benefit for ETM LA. And it was Silva's idea. I mean, he called me, and I was like, how can I say no to this?
Well, wasn't it on the extra, the small blurb on Extra that you were name called. You were name checked on that.
Yep.
Maybe. They said that it was my idea?
As a charity event, Steve Wynn mentioned
that. I said I would do it if everybody would agree to do it to raise awareness for ETMLA.
Right.
But it wasn't my idea.
Okay. So John Silva, but a little connection to Lewis. Okay.
How's everybody doing? Good to see you all. Thank you for coming and supporting music and education. It's important. I'm ready. One, two, three.
Speaking of the name Lewis, I have a short story and then a question. So, I heard about the band when I heard All in Good Time off the Radio Tokyo tapes. I went back and you guys had one EP at the time, Baroque Hoedown. And then shortly afterwards, there was an announcement that there would be an in-store signing at a place called Lou's Records in Encinitas, California. Mm-hmm. So I show up for there, I bring my record, my 16 Tambourines record. You guys are all lined up at the counter, I get you to sign it. And you sign it G period Lewis Gutierrez. The G ran into to Lewis, so me and my friends called you Gluis.
You're not the only one. Silva called me Gluis quite a bit.
So why the name change from Greg to Lewis?
Sure. Well, my name's Gregory Lewis Gutierrez. Gregory comes from my grandfather on my father's side.
Okay.
My father's name was Jesus Maria Gutierrez. And so I was Gregorio Luis Gutierrez, and the Lewis part came from my mother's father. His name was Lewis Leonidas Murphy.
Oh.
So Gregory, hence Gregory Lewis. I mean, you know, with Irish Catholics and Spanish Catholics, you know, you have a history of naming your kids after your parents.
Absolutely.
And it's a great tradition. But growing up, I was always Greg. But as I started to get older and started to just think about my life through music, I just never really thought that Greg was a cool name. And I never identified with Greg because I always thought of Greg Brady, speaking of the Brady Bunch. Just never identified with him because I surfed and I skated and I did other athletic things, but I was never a jock. And Greg sounds like the sound of a guy who's like an athlete or something. And I thought Lewis sounded more florid and more soft and more artistic. And at the time, my girlfriend and I were talking about it, and I was like, well, if I just put my name on the record as Lewis, people will start calling me Lewis. It's not like I need to put out a press release and say, because we just only ever put out Salvation Army at that point.
Right.
And we were just about to become more popular and get a wider audience. And so she strongly encouraged me to do it because, you know, we'd talk about it. And I can't remember if it was her idea or my idea or it was just some, one day we were talking. But for sure, I never really identified with the name Greg. And I always thought Lewis was just a cooler name.
Okay, so I have a separate anecdote. I go to a Tower Records record signing in L.A., and at the time I was having an identification. I was having an identity crisis with my name because I always had to spell it, and I hated it. So I tell the band, here's my name, and I use my family nickname. So then you took time, and it's a big part of the album where you write out, my family nickname is BB. So you write, that's a cool nickname. When I was in school, my nickname was Gucci.
Yeah.
Is that true?
Yes.
So I have that on an album written in a silver pen, Greg Gucci Gutierrez. I always thought it was the funniest thing. And I thought you were possibly pulling my leg.
No,
I'm glad to know
that
it's real.
I mean, truth is, I've had a lot of nicknames, and they're not all flattering.
Sure.
But the two nicknames I had were Gooch and Gucci.
Oh, I love it.
Gooch.
Gooch. The Gooch. Okay, so we want to cycle back to the 3 o'clock. So one of the things that I find really interesting about this transition from Salvation Army with a heavy punk sound, then we move into different musical influences that are obviously kind of informing Baroque Hoedown. Then we go from Baroque Hoedown to 16 Tambourines to Arrive Without Traveling. And there's a different sound on each one. We hear that evolution really, really clearly. Was that change in sound more due to the band kind of being informed differently? Or was that, again, a producer kind of taking the sound in a different way?
From my perspective, the big shift in my guitar sound from Salvation Army to Baroque Hoedown was 100% Earl Mankey. So not only was I evolving as a guitarist and was thinking more critically about what to play and what role the guitar had orchestrally within a band and how to make it sound good, Earl really, really as a guitarist, he really brought that out of me. He really taught me a lot about instrumentation and orchestration and how a song sounds versus, you know, when you listen to it versus how it feels when you play it. And I learned a hell of a lot from him. And so he was a huge influence. I mean, by then, the Mickey had come up, I'm pretty sure, with the rhythm of I Go Wild. And I just learned it on the guitar, you know, and that's how you hear the riff on the guitar. I'm pretty sure that was Mickey. I could be wrong. By then I was writing songs with Michael, with the Cantaloupe Girlfriend, and there were a couple others, I think, and maybe even songs that didn't make the record. But I was starting to think much more critically about how a guitar played, or how the guitar played a role within pop music. And the sound was forming. So we were in that direction anyway, because we now had a drummer that played a much more focused patterns. You know, Troy was really all over the place and is wonderfully beautiful the way he plays. But Danny was just a very different guy. He was more focused and more sort of professional sounding. And then you had Mickey. And Michael was always tight on the bass. And so I was forced to evolve, to play up to their level.
Wow.
So that I think that's what happened on Baroque Hoedown. I can't remember, what are all the songs on that record? Cantaloupe Girlfriend, I Go Wild.
Marjorie Tells Me.
That's Real.
And then...
Sorry.
Sorry, and then you have a couple of bonus tracks on the Lolita pressing.
The Lucifer Sam.
Yeah,
so sorry. I think it was Michael's idea to do that song. I know the Plimsolls were big popular back then.
Yes.
A big popular band back then, and they had been covering it for a long time.
Uh-huh.
And they were really pissed that we recorded it and that it got popular on the radio.
Could be because it was a better cover.
Oh.
Well, that's just me talking out of turn.
I remember Peter Case complaining to me one time, like, you know, we did that song long before you guys did or something like that. Anyway, and then by the time we get to 16 tambourines. Now my mind is really, I think, flourishing with regard to songwriting. And I never wrote any of the lyrics. That was 100% Michael. I think some of the guitar parts that I wrote may have influenced his vocals, but I would say that was mostly him. I would bring him ideas, and he would turn them into songs.
Wow.
And we were really collaborative on many songs. I mean, I remember like this song, On My Own. That song, I wrote the song in the backseat of a car going from Hollywood to my mom's house, because I had a guitar with me and I was just noodling, and I had the riff and I had the chords and I had everything by the, you know, in that half hour period. And I took it to Mike, I called up Mike. I was like, Mike, you got to check this out. Yes. And he came up with that middle section that leads into the guitar solo. Mm-hmm. And it was one of those songs that just came together effortlessly.
Wow.
And it was really good. And it felt good. I mean, it pulled us in a slightly different direction too, because that was very uncharacteristic of the band at that time. Songs like Jet Fighter, the riff, Mickey wrote the chorus part, because mm-hmm. I had come in with the guitar part, and because I'd written that on the piano at my mom's house. She had an upright piano, and I was writing a lot of songs and parts on the piano at that time, and they came into one rehearsal, and I said, "Look, check this out." And I had the bass part that goes down, and then I had the melody, which led to the keyboard part, and then Mickey had this. I got this cool part that could work as a chorus, and again, that song wrote itself. It was probably one rehearsal we had. Somebody has a recording of it, because we used to rehearse in the downstairs rumpus room at my mom's house at that point.
Nice.
And so, yeah, I mean, that record was really fun, and it was really, for me, it was our best record, because it showed so many different facets of the band. Michael's voice never sounded better. I feel like my guitar playing was really the most focused on that record. Everything had its place. And the songs were, I think the songs were good.
Great.
Extremely. Yeah.
You know?
So was this the green piano at your mom's house?
Yeah,
we've heard
green.
Stories about the green
yeah,
piano.
Yeah, it was, well, it was brown. It was a traditionally brown mahogany type piano, but my mom thought it was a good idea to sort of faux paint it with like white and then green brush strokes on it. It's still there. I think it's still at my mom's house because my brother lives there now.
So you actually wrote some songs on that piano.
Oh, 20 or 30 or 40. I mean, you know, not all made it to record, but certainly, yeah.
So then you transitioned from 16 Tambourines into Arrive Without Traveling.
Right. So
different sound.
Totally different sound because whereas the first two records, 3 o'clock, was Earl Mankey,
mm-hmm.
That next record was Michael Hedges, the English guy. Big, big, manly looking manimal with red hair and a beard and everything. It's just crazy. And by then we were writing songs like Her Edge Revolving, and I think you've heard people have talked about how that song came about. We were trying to be the Nas, and I came up with the riff, I'm pretty sure, and then we had the chords just naturally came in the middle. It was a really fun, that is a really fun song to play. And Knowing When You Smile, I always think of it as sort of like a Stranglers type song, and it's a really, I think it's a really cool song. I still like it to this day. Mrs. Green, I was never too fond of the song.
No,
I wasn't, to be candid. But it's a good song. I see why people like it. Girl with a Guitar, fun to play, but I had nothing to do with it. We were trying to evolve, and I was pushing to be more guitar-oriented. I wanted, because at that point in music, we're talking about the middle 1980s,
right.
And you know, it's more keyboards, more keyboards, more keyboards, and it's like I didn't really like that, and so I wanted there to be more guitar, so I pushed heavy for that, and I think with that first song, Her Head's Revolving, it makes a statement that we are a guitar band,
right.
At least in my mind, and I can't even remember most of the songs, but that was a really fun experience because. You know, we got to go to Germany, and I rode with the Manimal in his Porsche on the Autobahn, and it was like, we're going 150 miles an hour, and I'm like 22 years old, and I'm like, what could be better?
Wow.
Life doesn't get any better than this. And we lived in the studio, and the studio was really state-of-the-art, and it was in this small little town with the river going past it, and the food was great, and the experience was fantastic, and we went to Nuremberg once or twice, and I remember it being very, very cold and drinking like this mulled wine, like a Glühwein, I think they call it. And it was the first time I'd ever been out of the continent of the United States.
Wow.
So it was a really exciting thing for a 22-year-old kid from Harbor City.
Nice. Well, you're on the top of the world. Her Head's Revolving gets on MTV. And then the next thing that I hear through the paint box is Lewis is gone from the band. How do you go from being... basically on the top of the world as a 22-year-old to your departure with the 3 o'clock?
Well, there were a few things that happened interpersonally within the band that I wasn't happy with. And, I mean, you're right. What could be better? We've been asked to be the opening act for REM.
Right.
For like 35, 40 dates. That was an honor for us because now we'd hit a new high, and we were signed to IRS Records, and this was at the point where we were positioned to really break out, and I recognized it and I appreciated it, but I was just struggling with my relationship with Michael, and I just feel like there was tension that didn't need to be there. But was and as a result, I thought, well, I see that I'm starting to hear new songs that are coming, and I'm thinking I want to be more sort of guitar oriented. They want to be more synth oriented. I don't know that I can go through an entire tour feeling the way I feel. So I was like, you know, maybe I'll just quit the band. And I thought, because at that point, I think I'm 23, and you don't realize how good you have it until you don't have it anymore.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like, it's not easy to get back to be in a band like the 3 o'clock, and it just happens so easy. And then you got to replicate that into another venture. But I made the decision to go, and I remember Jay Boberg, who's the president of IRS Records, he called me to his place in Manhattan Beach, and he, for about 2 hours, we talked, and he really, not pleaded, that's a strong word, he really petitioned for me to not leave the band.
Okay.
And he put a lot of pressure on me, and he goes, you know, you guys got all this, and we're going to do this for you, and blah, 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 blah. But in my mind, I had already made the decision. And in my life, when I make a decision, I just do it. And I don't look back. And so I agreed to stay with the band until they could find a replacement. And so I think there were two or three or four shows. And the last one was at Verizon Wireless Amphitheater down in Irvine Meadows, I think it's called. Mm-hmm. And I remember by then I was friends with Molly Ringwald and C. Thomas Howell, and they came to the show and as my guests. And it was as I'm driving home that night after the show and they're getting on their tour bus to go to the next day, I felt really at peace with it. It would have been fun to go and do that whole tour and then say, all right, screw you guys, I'm out of here after the last concert. But that wouldn't have been fair to them, and I don't think that I would have enjoyed it.
Wow.
So it was, but I definitely have this recollection of saying, all right, I went out on top with the band. That was a great show.
Wow.
Really fun.
Well, I can say candidly that the two albums after you left were not very good at all. So it felt like what you had added to the band, being a part of the band, was crucial because what the band put out after your departure.
That.
And I've said that to Michael and to Danny as well. So
I appreciate you saying that. Thank you. I think, just to comment on that quickly, I think that it was the very tension that drove me from the band that probably added to our creative success.
Mm-hmm.
I have to say that with candor and honesty, and out of respect for Michael's ability, because I've always felt that guy, his bass playing is underappreciated.
Absolutely.
There
are
very few people that can sing and play the way he does. And Danny's great too. Not to take anything away from Danny, but I mean, you don't have a band without Michael Corsio, because it was his vision. It was his from day one. It was always his. He had this vision and he knew it. And he and I, we were a DIY type of guys. Do it yourself. I mean, in the sense that we just figured, why not us? Let's just do it and let's make our own flyers for these shows. And let's, you know, but I appreciate you saying that I added something to the band.
Oh, absolutely.
And for us, it was really interesting when we spoke with Jason Faulkner. He mentioned you specifically, that he looked up to you and looked up to your guitar playing. What did he say? He said, you were my guitar
idol.
My guitar idol.
And the day that he got to play
that's
with
a stretch.
You.
Yeah.
No.
Well, those are his words.
Yeah.
I mean, That was a really interesting interview, and he mentioned you by name, and he said it was something very surreal to be able to be in that band, yet occupying a space that belonged to Lewis.
Mm-hmm. Although he did not care for the band, he was
the sound at the time
that the band put out during his time, and he felt it was a huge honor to be on stage with you recently when you did the
Wild Honey
event.
That was the second time I had met him. The first time I had met him was backstage at the Troubadour when we did that reunion show with the Troubadour, which was a hell of a lot of fun. And but then I got a call from Dave Jenkins, who's one of the two organizers for Wild Honey.
Yes.
Right.
And he was very timid about asking me if I would mind Jason playing on stage with us. And I was like, fuck yeah, of course, I'd love to do it. That'd be great. I mean, we've been in the same band, but never been on the same stage.
Right.
And so I was all for it from the instant he asked me.
Wow.
And the interaction between the two of you on stage was really fun to watch.
You looked like you guys were having a blast.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
You could just see on Jason's face, just him gleaming,
joy.
Looking over
at
watching, and it looked like it was mutual too. So.
Well, just a quick anecdote that's a sidebar to that. Is that if you notice on stage, there's Jason, me, Michael, Danny, Adam, but then there's a guy standing off to the other side of the stage who's just playing rhythm guitar.
Yeah.
He's my boss at my company.
Oh, wow.
and he's my manager at the financial services company where I work, and he and I talk about music all day long. And he grew up in, I guess he went to Kent State, and I think he grew up in Akron, and we talk about all we ever do is talk about music. And whenever we talk about music, we get nothing done that day. Production goes way down. And I have to kick him out of my office. But his name's Bob Max. And I just got the idea, like, wow, you know, wouldn't it be a great opportunity for him, who's never played on a stage in front of that many people, for him to be in a band and to have that experience.
Wow.
And so I called up the guys in the band. I'm like, look, this is going to happen. You're going to say yes, and you're going to allow this guy to play rhythm guitar. And I thought Bob was going to bail, like because I wasn't sure if he was going to follow through. But he did. He followed through, and he played it, and he just had a great time. And he got to meet all those people backstage, because there's a lot of celebrity types back there. It's a real fun event to participate in, and I could just tell he was tickled.
That would have blown my mind.
Yeah.
Can you imagine? Hey, how would you like to play in front of about 8? Yeah, what's that theater hold about?
I
think it's 1,200 people.
Wow,
still,
I think.
Yeah,
then if you notice, when we did the Paisley Underground reunion at the Grammy Museum, he was on stage then. Too.
He was my unidentified person.
Yeah, we're trying to figure out who it was.
Okay, so as you can tell, this is my teacher background. I take notes on everything. So that night, I was trained to just memorize who was on stage. I'm writing down, and I wrote down unknown guy.
Unknown guy on guitar.
Now I know who it is. Wow.
Mystery solved.
You're a good friend to have.
Right.
That is so cool.
Yeah, it's the kind of thing that, if somebody else were in a position to do that for me, I wish they would.
I just like this because Jeff and I are, as you can probably tell, we're huge fans, but one of the things that we've enjoyed when we see you on stage is you seem to be having a lot of fun, and it sounds, you know, everything that you've been telling us about when you've come back, there's been a different motivation. And there's a different connection with different people, your daughters,
right.
You know, Coachella, your boss. Here's an opportunity. What do you think? And I'm going to give you an offer you can't refuse, guys. So this guy's coming. I mean, it just seems like now music has maybe a different pull or maybe a different motivation. And, you know, it's really endearing as a fan. It's really lovely to hear that.
Yes, and it absolutely looks like you're having a blast when you're on
stage. Oh, yeah.
And the more recent shows. So,
yeah, we'll delve into that.
Yes.
But.
We were so excited to talk to Lewis that we didn't want to waste the opportunity, and we definitely asked more questions than we had time for. So we're splitting this episode into two parts. Tune in next week for part two.
In that sense, it's very, unusual to have gone through that experience in that very short amount of time.
Right.
And for people to be taking an interest in it.
There's nothing in your music library.
I don't know. Well, I don't know what Siri and Alexa and all the other...
That's my work phone. Hang
people,
on.
No problem.
We did an EP, I think, like a 5-song demo, which led us to Lisa Fancher, which led to that first record, which we did in 3 days, I think. Which led